First of all, welcome to everyone for joining us today. This is NYSO's October webinar, as Todd just mentioned. Let me go ahead and do a little bit of information on how to use the webinar system so that you can go ahead and send in questions throughout. As you can see, in terms of seeing the presentations, you won't need to do anything on your end. Our presenters will use their system in order to move the slides forward in front of you. We have also put all of the attendee lines on mute to this point. That's to eliminate some background noise for our speakers. However, we do want to make certain that you send in questions as many as possible throughout today's event. In order to do so, you just click on the Q&A tool at the top of the screen, and we've already had a little bit of practice with that, so thank you. And you just go ahead and send in your questions that way. We will be answering the questions orally. However, if we are retaining a record of all questions that are sent in, so if we can't get to them all, we'll make certain to answer them later. We will be posting all of the questions up on our website following this event, along with our presenter answers. We will also be posting up on our event site all of these slides so that you will have those available to you in a printable format. And as you heard, we are doing our best to record this. We will make certain that there is an archive available for you following this event. It's usually, if all goes well and this is recording properly, it will be available in about 24 to 48 hours. And we will be sending out an email to let you know how to access that archive. If there is a problem, we will make certain that archive is available for you as well. It may just be a couple more days. Regardless, we will send an email to confirm that with you.
Excuse me, this is the operator.
Yes, thank you.
I am actually going to join the live meeting support team to the call, so I'm going to have to disconnect my line, but they will be joining the call shortly to determine why it's not recording.
Great, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
And for all of our attendees, you can see on the screen in front of you that we do have additional 2010 events for this year. We have every month our open teleconference, which is a free open call that provides updates on current work within NYSO. You could see that our next one will be focusing on Institutional Identifiers Working Group. That working group is otherwise known as I2, and they're going to be giving an update on where their work stands and what the next steps might be. That will be followed in November by a call about the work of the DAISY Revision Working Group. That is a standard that is undergoing a revision. It is commonly known as the DAISY Standard, otherwise known as the Digital Talking Book Standard. In addition, in December, we will be having a teleconference journal article version survey that was conducted in June of this year, and the results that we have found about how people are using metadata about defining article versions in their systems. In addition, we are having our two final webinars in November and December, focusing in November on the case of the disappearing journal, and in December about providing accessibility for the disabled. And with that, I'm going to just double check and see if our live meeting technical assistance has joined the telephone yet. It looks like not. So, Todd, I'm going to go ahead and hand off to you to do a proper introduction to today's event.
Hey, thank you, Karen. And, again, I'd like to add my apologies to the technical situation. At least we have a voice recording of this event, which we can go along with the slides that we'll have posted. So you all definitely will have access to the archive once the event is completed. But I would like to thank you all and welcome you to NYSO's October webinar. It's only as good as the metadata, improving OpenURL quality and knowledge-based quality. It's another great program for you all, and looking forward to our presenters today. The OpenURL standard has become a critical component of information distribution since it was first published as a NYSO standard in 2004. The OpenURL provides a framework for delivering context-specific content to end users. It solves what has often been called the appropriate copy problem. There are potentially dozens of options for where to direct a user to content that they search for and where that content might reside online. Some of those copies might have different access controls, rights negotiated, or different versions of the content, or even associate different associated services. And where a user goes once presented with context-sensitive linking could have a significant impact on their experience. Discovery and delivery of content online is driven by metadata, both about the objects, about the rights, about the linking syntax, as well as the context in that environment. In an analog world, humans are much more forgiving about errors in metadata. Going back a ways, a misspelling on a card catalog isn't necessarily going to stop most people from discovering an item on the stacks. Computers, however, are much less forgiving. There are myriad opportunities for metadata to cause discovery or delivery processes to fail. Sometimes computer systems can recover, and sometimes they cannot. Most of the time, end users don't know what they're not seeing because of these problems, or possibly they may become frustrated because the systems aren't returning the results that they know exist. However, addressing open URLs and the systems behind them, they work most of the time to provide incredibly useful information. As I said, most of the time, they work exceptionally well. Of course, we're looking at to address those problems in that 5 to 15% of the time when they don't. There are ways that publishers can improve the situation. There are obviously ways that systems providers can improve things. And there are also ways that we can all do to become much more educated about the critical components of the systems that we're using, how they work together, and where sometimes they collapse. Doing so will help us to address the remaining problems and improve experience for all of our patrons. And NYSO has been engaged in two projects to address and improve these systems. During today's program, you'll hear from both of those projects, the IOTA project and the KBART project. Our first speaker is going to address the IOTA project, which stands for Improving Open URLs Through Analytics. Elizabeth Winter, who is Electronic Resources Coordinator at Georgia Tech Library and is a member of the working group, will be presenting. Joining Elizabeth is Adam Chandler, who is Database Management and E-Resources Librarian at Cornell University Library. Adam will be joining Elizabeth during the Q&A portion of the presentation. So with that, I will pass the microphone, such as it is, on to Elizabeth so that she can begin her presentation.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to assume that you can hear me just fine. Let me know if not. I am on a Skype connection, so let me know if you've got any trouble hearing me. Thanks, Todd. I'm going to try and move through quickly so we can make up some time. So if I need to slow down, somebody please alert me. This is, as Todd said, an overview of the IOTA project. And that is me and Adam Chandler, so you get some sense for who you're listening to today. Quick overview of where we're headed. We're going to talk a little bit about what the project is, the background, some of the problems and goals of the project, some of the benefits of the project. Hopefully this is the part where you'll see the value in the work that we're doing. A few more details about the current work that we are engaged in. Talk about some of the issues that we are currently running into and some upcoming events and ways to follow the work that the IOTA Working Group is doing. This is our lovely logo, so you'll see this in places associated with our project, so you'll recognize it. And to get into a little bit of the background, I'm not going to talk about the Open URL Standard. I'm going to assume you're all familiar with that. Todd did do a bit at the beginning on it and the history of it. In the interest of time, I'm not going to do anything about that. As Todd said, IOTA is improving open URLs through analytics. A little bit about the history and kind of tell you some of the what and why of the group. So Adam Chandler at Cornell started thinking about this when Cornell had a product called Link Finder Plus, an open URL resolver, and they couldn't really figure out why sometimes an open URL wasn't working. And as Todd mentioned, it's still sometimes a little bit difficult to figure out why. So he started reading up on the problem and kind of folding in with that time-wise. There's a Cornell professor who wanted to improve linking out of the database, Lane Philologique. I apologize to those of you who are fluent in French for my pronunciation of that. So this professor came to Adam and asked him, you know, is there any way for you to help me improve the linking out of my database so that users are more successful in finding the content that they're looking for? So Adam and one of his colleagues wrote a Mellon planning about 2 years ago now to see if they could find a way to measure the open URLs in this database and determine how they could be improved. And so out of this, of course, as a result of the grant, they ended up writing the report and then realized this was a bigger problem that lots of folks potentially would be interested in. So he took the proposal to NYSO to start to build this working group. And the last several months, we've been gathering data. Currently, we have about 9 million open URLs in the system that I'm going to be showing you. And as I mentioned, there's a system that Adam has built for running some reports to give us some information about the quality of our open URLs. So I'm going to switch over quickly to the polling application. If you all are still there and still awake and you have your mice handy, I'm going to ask you a quick poll here. To give your opinion on this statement. A significant problem for link resolvers is the generation of incomplete or inaccurate open URLs by databases, for example, ANI products. So please indicate how you feel about this. Looks like we've got some feedback coming in. Some folks are still with us. That's good. All right.
Excuse me, ma'am. This is the operator?
Yes.
The operator that was getting technical support online, she is still trying to get them online for you.
Don't worry about it now, and we can go ahead and attend to that after.
Okay, ma'am.
But thank you very much.
Okay, ma'am. I'll let her know.
Thank you. Don't worry, everyone. We'll make certain that there is an archive available for you. We don't have confirmation that the recording's working, but it tells us it is. So we will make certain that that's available. In the meantime, go ahead, Elizabeth. Sorry for interrupting.
Okay. No, that's no problem at all. It was good timing actually waiting for folks to submit their responses. So it looks like about 83% of you either agree or strongly agree with this statement. And that is, let's switch back to the slide for a second here. A study that was done recently, we reported on 72% of respondents to an online survey either agreed or strongly agreed that this was a significant problem. So what we're trying to figure out, part of what we're trying to figure out at least, is why open URLs don't always work. So I'm also interested in your thoughts on this. So here is a second poll. About how often your patrons experience problems with open URLs. Like, Daly's winning so far. So it looks like Daily and Weekly primarily, at least somebody's having a problem with an open URL fairly regularly, once a week or in many cases a lot more frequently than that. And then I have one final question for you. What do you think causes the most problems with open URL links? Okay, so it looks like a good portion of us think that incomplete or poorly constructed open URLs are at least part of the problem. Errors in link resolver knowledge base. Of course, those of us who work with knowledge bases realize that this often is part of the problem. 20% of us don't know, which I think is an honest and a good answer, because in a lot of cases we're not really sure exactly what's happening depending on what level of access we have to knowledge base and link to information parsers and those sorts of things and our experience with those. So it seems like there are lots of different kinds. I think I've gone to the wrong slides. There we go. All right. So there could be a number of reasons why open URLs don't always find the success that we hope they would or that they are intended to. So the goals of the IOTA project, it's a two-year research project. At the end, ultimately, I hope that we will be able to produce a technical report on the findings that we have found. This is a little bit different from some of the NISO projects in that it's really a research project attempting to examine data and see if we can draw any conclusions that will help us develop a qualitative report at the end that will help, hopefully, an open URL provider to quickly compare their open URL quality to that of their peers. And we hope to be able to use a method that's fair and transparent and scalable across millions of open URLs and hundreds of providers. Users, of course, benefit greatly from OpenURL and the resolver system that currently exists. And OpenURL has enabled them to reach the scholarly information they're looking for much faster now than at a time before link resolvers. Nevertheless, following a reference link in an attempt to access full text, which most often is what users are looking for, it frustrates users too often when full text is actually available but they don't find it. And often, as we have already seen, several of us, many of us suspect that at least part of the cause of that is that the metadata in the OpenURL sent by the source vendor database is just not sufficient to link the user to available full text. So some of the desired outcomes we have for the IOTA project are that we would be able to produce some recommendations for source vendors. We're focusing on developing, as I mentioned, a qualitative report to help each OpenURL provider to be able to compare quickly their OpenURL quality to the quality of the other OpenURL providers. It would be nice also for us if we could, and for everyone, if we could make some recommendations to link resolver vendors. Several of you in the poll a minute ago did suspect that knowledge bases are part of the issue, and also maybe there are other parts like link to syntaxes which result in failed open URLs. So we would like to be able to make some recommendations to those link resolver vendors to help them with their part of the process to improve open URL quality. Ultimately, we would love for this to result in better open URLs across the industry, which means more success for our users, which, again, is really what we're trying to do with all of this. So the work we're doing is helping us to determine whether these outcomes will be possible and how we might go about making those recommendations that will allow the scholarly information community to achieve them. So let's talk a little bit about the current work that we're doing. The OpenURL quality reporting system, I've given you the URL here. It'll be on the final slide as well, openurlquality.niso.org. This is a system, as I mentioned earlier, that Adam developed as a result of the background work I described earlier, into which batches of OpenURL collected from libraries and intermediaries can be loaded. And you can see here, as I mentioned earlier, we have about 9 million OpenURL currently in the system from the universities and providers listed. The system allows us to use analytics and run reports to examine the types of elements that are showing up in OpenURLs, the frequency with which a variety of OpenURL elements, such as things like article title, ISSN, DOI, author last name, start page, end page, those sorts of things, show up in OpenURLs from a wide variety of source databases and source vendors. And we describe these reports more fully on the project's website. They're a bit complex at first, so if you're really exceptionally interested in the project, I'd recommend going to the site and playing around a bit with it. It's open for anyone to mess with. Essentially, there's three types of reports. One that tells you the elements that are showing up in OpenURL, one that shows patterns of elements that are showing up in OpenURL, and then a frequency report that shows with which OpenURL elements, things like article title, ISSN, DUI, those sorts of things, again, show up in OpenURLs from source databases and source vendors. And the example I'm going to show here is a source report. So this is actually a screenshot of the interface you'll find when you go to the IOTA site. So this is a source report, and you can see here I selected Georgia Institute of Technology, which is my institution's data, from for 2010. And this data is for the source isinet.com, which is how OpenURLs that come from Web of Science are reported. So this is the actual report that I just run with those last three steps. This one shows how many OpenURLs the system analyzed for the isinet.com source from the first quarter of 2010 for Georgia Tech. And you can see here the list of elements analyzed in the first column. The second column shows the percentage of OpenURLs from this particular source that contain each of these elements versus the third column, which shows the overall percentages from Georgia Tech for the same time period that contain those elements. So those are all the OpenURLs, what percentage of total OpenURLs from that time period contain the element. And I think this report is really one of the most helpful ones in the system. It's helpful for showing how complete a particular vendor's OpenURLs are compared with all other OpenURL vendors' OpenURLs. So that was a quick review of one of the reports. So some of the current things working on in the group, I should have mentioned also, we've really just been working for the last several months with a fairly newly formed group. So we're still trying to figure out really the best ways to attack the problem. One of the things that we're hoping to do is develop a vendor completeness index. And one of the premises we're working with and attempting to test is that the more information a source provides as part of an OpenURL, the higher the likelihood that OpenURL will enable a user to reach full text if it's available. So we're trying to answer the question, is it possible to develop a vendor completeness index that would show us the relative ranking of source vendors based on how complete their OpenURLs are. Another thing we're looking at is element weighting. So it's, of course, not just the number of elements present in an OpenURL that lead to success. It also matters which elements are present. So, for example, you may have an OpenURL with lots of elements, but if for a journal article one of those elements isn't the ISSN, then your user may still have difficulty reaching full text through a link resolver. But on the other hand, there are what would appear to be very meager OpenURLs that contain a couple of elements, but if one of those elements happens to be a DOI or a PubMed ID, then that URL is likely to be successful at pointing the user to full text because those elements are essentially complete within themselves. So we're trying to figure out if it's possible to create a weighting index for elements that are likely to show up in OpenURLs to determine if we can get a relatively accurate picture of how good the OpenURLs coming from a particular source are overall. Some of the issues that we're running into, again, like I said, this is a research project, so we're having to gather and examine a lot of data as well as run test reports with a variety of data to make sure that they're valid. That they match up with the reality of what is and is not happening when a user clicks on an OpenURL resolver link and attempts to locate full text. And this entails making sure the data that's loaded is complete and accurate. And Adam, as I mentioned, and also Jim Wisner from ISI have been working really diligently on this. Another issue we're dealing with is how to determine which OpenURLs to look at. So do we only want to look at URLs for things like e-journals where the element, genre equals journal, or do we look at everything? Do we want to deal with ebooks or conference proceedings or any other kind of material types that can be represented by open URLs? Then, of course, as I said, weighting the elements is a challenge because we know anecdotally that some elements are more important than others, but we really want to be precise in our assigning of weight to the various elements to ensure that if a source ends up with a low ranking, it really is consistently producing open URLs that are not very good or very complete. Of course, we understand that publishers and vendors' reputations are at stake, so we want to make sure we're doing this as diligently and accurately as possible. And then another thing, as I mentioned briefly, the role of link resolvers and resolver settings in the success of open URL resolution is another issue. Each open URL resolver maintains its own proprietary linking syntax. So it's possible that an open URL that doesn't resolve on one link resolver might resolve for another. And at least in some link resolvers, the customer also has the ability to tweak these link to syntax to require or not require certain elements from an inbound open URL. So this further complicates the issue. So the last thing I have listed here is case studies. In addition to looking at aggregate data and reports from the analytics system, it's also going to be important for us to examine particular use cases to see if the aggregate findings, weightings, completeness index seem to hold up in the, quote, real world of actual open URL resolving situations. Related to that will be choosing data for case studies, making sure that we test enough individual open URL situations on a variety of link resolvers to see if what users are actually experiencing matches up with what we're seeing in the reports. So, and to sum up, there are a lot of variables, as you can see from this short summary, and there are many different ways of attacking the problem. But again, not much really useful work has been done in this area, and I think we're making some good progress. So I think we're off to a good start. And I want to leave you with some upcoming events. We do have a presentation on IOTA at the Charleston Conference for any of you who are attending. It's Friday, November 5th at 2 p.m. Rafal Kasprowski from Rice University and Susan Merson, who are both members of the working group, will be presenting on our initiative. You can attend that. And then hopefully some other conferences soon, so stay tuned. And for more information, again, the first one is a link to the system that you can actually go in and play around with running some of the reports. The NISO page listed there. And then Adam has also started a blog, openurlquality.blogspot.com, where you can also follow the work that we're doing. And if you are Twitter types, you can follow IOTA on Twitter this way. And there's also a scrolling box on the IOTA page for tweets related to IOTA, and you can use this hashtag that's listed here for those. So I think I am going to wrap up now. Of course, if you've got questions, Adam and I are both here during the Q&A time. We are happy to answer them. Just make sure you send them in as Karen instructed. And I'm passing the mic back now.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. This project is really amazing, and I appreciate that both that you are here to give an update on this, and Adam, as you mentioned, is here as well for the questions. So for our attendees, please do send in questions about this project. It's obviously looking at things at what is a significant problem in a unique way, and I think that you all are coming up with some great reference on which to really gauge whether or not there are problems, to be able to figure out if there's a solution to a particular vendor who might be having issues. By looking at these reports, you're able to sort of get a sense of what's working and what's not. And certainly as you all look more in depth at some of the projects that you were mentioning, for instance, the weighting, I think that you'll be able to see the benefits of your project even more. But again, for all of our attendees, please do send in your questions. As a reminder of how to do so, you just click the Q&A button at the top of the screen and send in the questions that way. We'll be holding most of our questions until the end of today's event. However, we will be making certain that whatever questions are sent in are also put up on the NISO webpage, and we'll make certain that there are answers there as well. So thank you very much. I know that we did start a couple minutes late, so I am going to go ahead and move forward and hand it off to our next speaker, Andreas Biedenbach, who is the Haybart Working Group co-chair, is here to speak about the joint NISO UKSG KBART initiative and the phase two work that is going on at this point. So, Andreas, to you.
Thanks, Karen. So, first of all, I have to apologize for my voice today because I came down with a cold, so I hope you will still be able to understand me. So, as Karen mentioned, I'm KBART working group co-chair for NISO. We also have a co-chair for UKSG, that is Sarah Pearson, and she will join us later to answer some questions, so I guess you will get to know her later during the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So, KBART, what does it stand for? So I got two nice pictures from one of our working group members, actually Jason Price, who did another presentation at NASIC earlier on this year. And, yeah, it has nothing to do with Bart Simpson, as you see on the left-hand side, and nothing to do with the BART transportation system in San Francisco. KBART stands for the Knowledge Bases and Related Tools. So what I'm going to present to you today, it just takes some time, obviously, to change the slide. There we are. So first of all, I would like to tell you who is behind the KBART initiative. So what is the goal of the KBART initiative, which is a universally accessible holdings data format? Where will KBART apply in the end? When does it happen? The answer is it's happening now, actually, because there has been a first phase, which was finished earlier this year, and there's also a report available. As you can see, there's a link here mentioned on the slide. And right now, we're actually working on phase two of this project. So there have been some recommendations coming out of phase one about the data format. You will see an example later on about the update frequency, et cetera. And now in phase two, we are concentrating on the details and are refining all these requirements. So why are we having KBART? Because it should guarantee better access for users because of accurate holdings data. And how can you help? I will give you some examples. If you're a librarian or a publisher, you will see later on in the slides, I will try to tell you how you can help and make this format more accessible in the future. Well, unfortunately, it takes quite some time to change the slide, so I apologize for that.
I'm seeing the slides moving ahead, Andreas. It might just be that you're on a little bit of a slower connection.
Probably my connection was just bad.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. So I'm just waiting to see the slides, but there's no other reason. Sorry for that. So who's behind KBART in the end? So it's, as we mentioned before, it's UKSG and NISO. And in the working group, there's different groups represented, knowledge-based vendors, content aggregators, publishers, subscription agents, libraries, and consortia. You can also see a full list of the members, but I thought that might not be that personal. So on the next slide, you will actually see the working group members for phase two. And as you can see, I still cannot see it, actually. It's quite a variety of different organizations represented. So we have representatives from OCLC, SFX, Serious Solutions, the Royal Society, myself from Springer, we have Svet, Taylor and Francis, and from the university side, we have the University of Birmingham of Wyoming, Jason Price for Claremont College and the California Digital Library. So it's quite a mixed group, as you can see, but a very productive group in the end, I have to say. And of course, if you have any questions and you know one of these people in person, then just feel free to contact them. So just waiting for my next slide again. So what is KBART? KBART stands for Knowledge Bases and Related Tools. So as we mentioned before, it's a joint project by UKSG and NISO, and it's based on a research report which was published in 2007 by UKSG, which is called Link Resolvers in the Serious Supply Chain, so which examined the importance of the supply chains and the data delivered therein for link resolver purposes, et cetera. And in the end, it's a set of practical recommendations for the timely exchange of accurate metadata between content providers and knowledge-based developers. So So what is important in the end that we have a unified data format which can be used for all the data transfers in the end, because it's one of the main challenges today actually that we have to send out, from my perspective as a publisher, for example, we have to send out different sheets with information in different formats to different providers about holdings information for our customers. So one of the main goals in future to have that standardized, to have one common format and one method for the data exchange. And what has been recommended in phase one, actually, that's something you will see on the next slide. Unfortunately, my connection is still pretty slow. So you see, that's a pretty simple exchange format, which was agreed upon in the phase one of the working group. And as you can see, it's very much journal focused at the moment. So one of the tasks in phase two is also to apply the standards for ebook data exchange, etc., for consortial data, all this. But what came out of phase one is this recommendation for a format which is pretty simple. The recommendation actually is a CSV format, and you see it should contain like the publication title, the print identifier, the ISSN, the online identifier, meaning the electronic ISSN, the coverage date, etc., title information, author information, information about embargo. So that's our basis at the moment, the information which came out of phase one, what we're working on right now, and to refine these requirements in phase two. And as I said, we want to also apply them for ebooks, for example, and also for consortium metadata. So what's in the knowledge base today? So you see there's a lot of information coming from different sites. You see that we have the title relations containing ISSN, ISBN information. We have licensing information about the holdings, so which packages were bought or which titles were bought, etc. We have the data transfer, so it needs to be accurate. There needs to be a timely update, so we need to have a certain frequency in the end. All of these criteria play a very important role so that we can guarantee a smooth and reliable data transfer to the knowledge bases. So where does KBOT apply in the end? So you see that there's the publisher, and they host the information in databases, full-text databases, online platforms, but they also provide their data to ANI databases, search engines, all these new discovery services. So all kinds of services a user should benefit from when using his discovery tools, like the catalog, A to Z listing, resolver. So all this information should come together in the knowledge base, and of course it has to be accurate so that the user can identify and properly find all the information he's looking for and get access to the books or journals he should have access to. So therefore it's very important that the information, again, we have to stress it all the time, that the information that we send to the knowledge base providers is accurate in the end. And in order to achieve that, we think it's very important to have a unified data format. So, what's in your knowledge base, learning is the hard way. So that's from one of our working group members, actually. And he showed it to me during one of the conferences, what he's still doing at the moment. So when he's receiving the title list from publishers and wants to compare them to the knowledge base data, he still has to do a lot of manual work. Here you see some problem cases, like titles are not listed, access dates are not correct, title changes are not reported, et cetera, et cetera. And it takes him quite a long time to match all these data, I think a few months actually, And we're not talking about, like 10 or 100 joiners. We are talking about a four-digit number, as you can see in the last column. So that's something, of course, we want to prevent in future, that there's a lot of manual work involved in order to update the knowledge base data. So, that's the reason why we have KBAN. So what is important is that we have maintenance of accurate package content and coverage data. And of course, the standard should support the open URL, which is used for the link resolver, should also support e-journal MARC record delivery services. And it should enable us to automatically update the data in knowledge bases. And other problems that should be solved is, for example, like the reuse of ISSN, which is a quite common problem in case of title changes, et cetera, that there isn't a new ISSN available, for example. Embargo periods should be listed clearly. There shouldn't be any ambiguities. And, of course, there shouldn't be any inconsistent dates regarding coverage data, et cetera. Again, I'm sorry for my slow internet connection, but so from the library perspective, how can you help to that knowledge base vendors, publishers, et cetera, adopt the KBAN practices? From your perspective, mainly the publishers, I think. First of all, it would be nice if you learn what KBAN is and what it does. So, I mean, of course, it's one of the reasons for this webinar as well, but you will also find a lot more information on our website. I will mention them later on. You should insist on knowing what you're buying, so you should request really nice and usable lists from the publisher. And if you think that these lists are not adequate, then you should mention the KBAN standards and point them towards these standards so that they exactly know which data should be included. And, yeah, please insist on having this information so that in the end, I mean, it will only be for your benefit, as I mentioned earlier on, so because it's your user which will benefit from this unified data exchange format in the end. And, of course, if you talk to the sales representatives from the publisher, then also explain to them what your problems are. I mean, one of our working group members does that very well, I have to say. So that's, for example, how we got alerted about the necessity of a common format. And, of course, always follow up and try to get accurate lists as often as possible. So, who has endorsed the KBAN standard so far? So, first of all, we had the American Institute of Physics, Ex Libris, OCLC, and Sirius Solutions. And in mid-September, we announced some new endorsers, which were Alexander Street Press, Annual Reviews, EBSCO Information Services, Innovative Interfaces, and the Royal Society Publishing. Now the question, some of you might want to ask, how can you be endorsed for KBAN? And actually, it's pretty simple. So from a publisher perspective, you just have to submit a sample file to the KBAN working group. So you see that's our common email address here, kbaan@niso.org. And then our specialists will have a look at the file and give you some feedback. I will give you some information from the publisher perspective on one of the slides later on, so that you will know which standard apply. So as I mentioned, our specialists will have a look at these files and then get back to you if there's any issues or if it's fine and you're ready for endorsement. As you see, when the file format and content has been reviewed and everything is fine, then We will add you to our list and we'll also make that publicly available. So just an example, you saw the required fields early on. Here's an example of a journal list which was delivered by one provider who has had endorsed the KBAN standard. And here you see a very nice list of all the necessary information there, the publication titles, all the identifiers, the open URL, etc. So just how it should look like in the end. So as I mentioned before, for publishers, you can review the requirements on this web page mentioned here, and then you can format your e-journal and e-book data according to these requirements. What we also have on our website is a self-checker tool. So before you send the test data to us, you can ensure that they are conformed to the recommended practices and make the necessary corrections so that we don't have to go back and forth because of minor details all the time. And you have to make sure that you have a process in place for a regular data exchange, and that's something which we outlined in our KBAN report in section 5.2, which is also available on this website. And if you want to be part of the KBAN initiative, you can also be part of our registry website. I will show an example on the next slide. Let's just go there. Because if you want to provide data in the KBAN format, you can just mention all the necessary information on the KBAN registry, meaning the URL or FTP site that the data will be available. Here you see an example for AIP. So we have the platform URL, we have a contact, we have a contact email, contact phone number, and there we have the URL to metadata. So everybody who has been endorsed and is ready for the data exchange within the KBAN requirements can be added to this registry. So that everybody knows where the files can be picked up, and so that there doesn't need to be any email notifications or whatsoever. So I mentioned that we're working on phase two right now. So our main goal is to endorse more and more content providers or publishers, knowledge base providers. Of course, it's important that they're all compliant to our KBAN format. And yeah, we encourage you to further follow up on our KBAN initiative and have a look and see the benefits, because it's quite important right now that we spread the word and make clear that this topic is very important also going forward for the future, and especially for your users, that they are able to find all the data they want to find. So in particular, as I mentioned before, we are working on consortia specific metadata transfer, institution-specific metadata transfer, and the metadata requirement for ebooks, and open access is also a topic right now. So what we've done, we formed smaller working groups and who are taking care of these individual issues, and then we will discuss them in the bigger working group again and try to come up with some new recommendations for phase two. So just to summarize, what has knowledge-based management been before KBAN? As I mentioned, there was or can be a lot of manual work involved, like ISBN matching. First of all, you need to get a list in a certain way, so that if there's no automated way to get a list, you have to send emails, etc., to get a list of your holdings, etc. Then you might have to match ISSN, you might have to check coverage dates, etc., all manual work. And then in the end, you still have to decide whether the information is good enough and can be useful and not for your knowledge base. So that's what we want to avoid in future. We want to have everything automated as far as possible, of course. And yeah, the ultimate goal for the time after KVAD should be the following. So first of all, as I mentioned, it should be a universally accepted standardized publisher metadata should be available. They should be regularly distributed and available on demand, meaning, yeah, if they're distributed via an FTP server, everybody can pull them as needed. So we want to have a broad adoption. More content types should be covered. And something, yeah, like a vision for the future, that we will also be able to have consortia and institution holdings based on what is actually accessible from a particular IP. I think, yeah, that's a very nice goal. Yeah, as I said, something for the future, but, yeah, who knows. I hope that we will be able to achieve that at some point of time. So if you want to have more information, of course, we will be available for questions afterwards. But there's, of course, websites you can check. So first of all, the NISO website. That's the UKSG website. You can also send me an email or contact any of the other working group members that you know. Or if you would like to follow our activities, you can also join the KVAD interest group. You can sign up for it under the URL, and then you will be informed about the latest news and just follow our activities in a passive way. So you're not an active member of the working group, but you can receive all the necessary information. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andreas. I know this group has been very active. Certainly it had a nice, strong base on which to work after the phase one work report was published. With phase two, the main charge for the group has been to look at things like making certain that there is a registry of information, the endorsements that you described, as well as looking at the just additional ways to provide support for those who are interested in KVAD and what the recommendations provide. Certainly with phase two, as you pointed out, expanding on that and being able to then look at some recommendations for additional content types, I think will be very useful. I know the group is has focused much of its work thus far on the support, but is moving towards that next phase of recommendations as well. So certainly I echo your recommendation to those who are interested in KVAD and following it to join up to sign up to the interest group list. It's not an active list in the same way as a normal discussion list might be, as well as much as one where the group does provide updates on its work, and at times when there are need assistance with feedback, need information from the group, or want support for what they're doing, this is where they'll go to. So it's definitely a first stop for additional information about KVAD. But I do encourage you all to do take a look at both our NISO site and the UKSG site. We mirror each other on the content there to see if there's information that's missing, perhaps, where you'd like to find out more information as well. Andres, I know that a question did come in through for you. It looked like, though, the return bar was hit a little bit too early, so we only got the first half of the question. So hopefully, Kathleen, you'll send that in again, and we'll make sure to get Andres and perhaps Sarah when she joins us to answer that at the end of this event. And I do want to encourage others to send in questions as well. But thank you very much. And I want to go ahead and then move on to our final speaker of the day. Maria?
Yes. Hello. I am Maria Stanton. I'm the Director of Content Operations for Serial Solutions. And
it's at the bottom left of your screen there, Maria, the arrow bars.
Is it the down? Because I hit down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let me see if I can.
There we go.
Go.
Okay. So I think that it's my placement is interesting because I can speak from the perspective of someone who's dealing with all of this data today, and I believe that what you'll see is my presentation reinforces the need to support IOTA and KVAD is ultimately where I come to by the end of my presentation, and I'm still not paging down.
I can go ahead and move it down for you. I'm not certain.
Right.
If you want, I can help with you in the meantime.
So I will, I always like to start from the patron perspective. I like to go external, although we have touched on some of this, so I'll move through these slides fairly quickly and then get to the meat of the presentation, which is, you know, what do we get from a referring source? What data do we have in the knowledge base that we're dealing with from, you know, from the potential target sources? And then once we've, you know, once we've made those handshakes, what do we understand about the target sources that will drive the decisions we make about what elements or parameters we pass through in the open URL request? And then, you know, again, the world would be a better place if we could fully fund and support IOTA and KVART. So that's sort of the agenda for today. And let's move it to the next. So from the patron perspective, as Todd mentioned earlier, what they, you know, their goal is that the link leads to an article, to whatever treasured resource they're looking for, an article, a journal, a chapter, a patent. Next slide, please. So, in other words, they're a click or two away. They should be able to click directly to the full text from a citation. They start with the citation. They see a button that says, you know, get me the full text. They hit that, and it should lead to the full text. Next slide.
I'm pushing it as well, Marie. It looks like a...
Okay, there we go. So that one just built to the full text. So then the next slide. So from the patron perspective, when it doesn't work, as Todd mentioned earlier, and then as we saw in the poll, you know, quite often they don't actually know why it didn't work. They're frustrated, they'll go to another source or, you know, what have you, and their trust in that source or that resource is somewhat lessened. But again, it's frustrating and they don't know why. So our goal is to try to make that more consistent and more reliable for them. Next slide, please. And it shouldn't be a secret to anyone on this call that the dependence on electronic content and, by extension, the dependence on access tools such as mediated linking has increased. This is from the ARL statistics, 1993 to 2008, that electronic expenditures have grown sharply at a rate far exceeding that of library materials overall. As the graph shows, every year in the last decade, electronic material expenditures have grown anywhere between 2 and 10 times faster than other materials expenditures have. And again, I'm just sort of framing the problem. I think that this is something, as I mentioned, that isn't a, it's not a secret to anyone on this call. Moving on to the next slide, please. So to summarize what we're seeing, library users have become increasingly comfortable using electronic resources. We're much more dependent on those resources, and the patrons are expecting a consistent experience. And, you know, if we can give them that consistent experience, then our role in helping people find the best information to support their research, to support whatever activities have drawn them to our services, you know, we become that much more important to them. Next slide, please. So this gets into the meat of the what do we need to be looking at? And the problem that we have is we need alignment in three spots. There's the data that comes from the referring source, the parameters that they'll pass. What is it that we're tracking in the knowledge base about the potential target sources for that information? And then actually, how effective are target sources in handling an open URL request? So next slide, yes. Oh, and actually, I think I've pretty much covered this. So we can go on to the next slide from here. So these are the key parameters that we typically see coming from a referring source. Article title, journal title, date of publication, volume, issue, start page, standard identifier, and, you know, if we're very lucky, the digital object identifiers or PubMed identifiers. And I put that one on. Quite frankly, we don't see that as often as we'd like. And of, as was mentioned earlier by Elizabeth, of all of the potential identifiers that we could receive from a referring source, the digital object identifier is the most treasured of all, because it does unambiguously represent that referent article that that individual is seeking. And what does a typical knowledge-based provider track? So what does someone like a Serial Solutions fully track, typically track? We track full text coverage at the journal level. So as I mentioned, with the digital object identifier, if we can marry that with the information in the knowledge base, the digital object identifier is at the article level. We're tracking things at the journal level. So, you know, we're looking at and trying to clean up and massage information about journals, coverage dates, making sure the ISSN is correct, making sure that we know the full text start date, the full text end date, that we know embargo information. If we can marry that information up accurately with the article level information coming through, we'll have a much greater level of success and a much much better experience for the patron. But that's typically, this is the information that we're tracking: title, ISSN, full text start, full text end, journal level URL, and embargo. This is the meat of what we track. And how do we acquire that data? I'm just going to elaborate a little bit on some of the information that Andreas shared. We do receive a percentage of the files in a standard format. For example, we are beginning to see KBART formatted files come through to us. We also receive some files in an Onyx format, and, you know, for ebook providers, we also do accept MARC records. So, there are a few things out there that that reflect a more standard format, a more consistent format, and we do receive a small percentage of files in that format. Another percentage of electronic files are in some proprietary format from the content provider. So we have to sort of sort out, well, what is the format? How are they representing the information? What is their definition for the fields? You know, what are they, you know, which ISSN are they using? Sometimes it's not very clear. How do they represent dates? How do we need to massage that? How do we need to massage the embargo information? I would say currently a very high percentage of the electronic files that we receive are in some proprietary format from the content providers. And then finally, there is a percentage of what we track where there is no electronically available file. We simply have to review the website and derive the information that we need to maintain the knowledge base. That's a much smaller percentage currently than before, but that's what we currently receive. And the limitations on the files, most of the files don't include a full title history. So, for example, the one listed there, Freeman, this is how we receive the information from the provider. It's Freeman coverage from 1998 to the present. As you can see, we've looked at the information and determined that the title history for Freeman, it went through two different title changes during that time. And so that's what we have to represent in the knowledge base to make sure that we create a successful link for our users. Other examples, another provider sends us something indicating that we have, that they have R&D Magazine from 1994 to the present, and actually R&D Magazine was research and development until 2002. Those are a couple of cases of title histories. I also would remark on the fact that in the files we receive, coverage dates are not always accurate either. So, for example, one provider indicates that they'll be sending us public, they have the coverage for Public Relations Quarterly from 1965 to the present, and in reality on their service full text coverage ended in 2007. we need to, you know, we've discovered that, and so in our knowledge base we represent that it ended in 2007, so that if a link comes through, we're not trying to pass that user over to that particular platform for the full text for something since that's been published since 2007. And these are all things that we are currently having to deal with. It's not just a matter of the format of the data or the structure of the data. I think what you're seeing in these slides is that the accuracy of the data is just as important as whether or not, you know, they've clearly defined that this particular field is going to include the print ISSN or the EISSN. The accuracy of the data has to go hand in hand with a standard formatting for the data. And further data management, you know, there is some question about, well, are we getting an accurate ISSN, and what's the most appropriate version of the title to pass through to the potential target source? So beyond coverage dates and beyond title histories, one of the other areas that we look at is, you know, do we have an accurate ISSN? What variant titles should we have available for the link reviewer to consider? And what you'll see on the left on this screen are literally various ways that we've received the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology and the variant ISSNs that we've received. And our team has reviewed that against the MARC record for this particular title, determined what is the most appropriate ISSN to use to pass through to a target if we need to request the full text for this journal, is what's highlighted in the pink. But as you can see, these are all the variations, and in some case we didn't get an ISSN at all. So again, this is just reinforcing that concept of marrying accuracy with a standard format is really critical to supporting increased resolution of links and making better links for our users. So the result of all of this is that if we've gone through, we've manually massaged all of this data, we can ensure that the library's profile is accurate. So, for example, with Freeman, that all of that title history is going to be represented so that when someone tries to link through, they're going to find the articles that they're looking for, and that also an accurate title or an accurate ISSN is passed along to the target source. I mean, this sort of oversimplifies what it takes right now to do this, but at the end of the day, this is what we're trying to accomplish, is making sure that library's profile is accurate and that we're passing accurate data to the target source. So let's talk about the target source for a moment. After we've done all of this work, we're now looking for something. We're looking for an item that is below the journal level, typically. We're looking typically for an article or a chapter. And so we have to analyze the target source. What is going to best ensure the result that we're looking for that end user, that they're going to find that treasured article? And I'll just, that last bullet there, quite frankly, what we found is article title is typically problematic. In fact, that's something that we try to avoid passing if we can find other elements that will better guarantee we get the end user to the actual article that they're looking for. So, page down. So we actually spend a fair amount of time analyzing what will be successful with the target source and create a number of if-then scenarios for the potential link that will pass. So if from the referring source a DOI is provided, we use the DOI to create the article link. If a DOI is not provided, but ISSN, volume, issue, start page are used, are available, that's what we'll use to provide the article level link over to the target source. So we get the information in from the referring source, look to see, you know, what potential targets should be used to resolve and provide an article for that particular patron in that particular library. And then from there, the link resolver has to, you know, say, okay, with these targets, what's going to be most successful based on what their competencies are. And I should mention, we've actually found some targets where they were successfully resolving a DOI, but then later something about their system changed and they actually aren't as successful resolving a DOI anymore. Which I think as I was listening to the IOTA presentation, I was sort of thinking through some of those scenarios that we've seen where, you know, the comment about the comprehensiveness of the data that we passed through, that, I mean, it's an interesting concept to work through because, again, we found that target sources change over time and what might be successful at one point isn't successful at another point. And some of the things that you actually think would be the best things to do, you know, over time something might change and that is no longer the case. So there's a lot of analysis that we go through with our target sources and a lot of trending that we watch for with the target sources to make sure that our scenarios are accurate for that particular target. And so that's the question is, can we come together to do more? And honestly, I think that this meeting today is a reflection of what we can do. We can come together, support IOTA, support KVART, and work with, you know, the vendors, the content providers to ensure the accuracy of the data and the compliance with standard formats. I'm a huge fan of both projects. I think it's marvelous what they're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. That, I think, was a really nice way to close off the webinar in that we were able to see how some of the practices, so see how IOTA and KBART are having an influence when it comes to the reality of what you're dealing with. Like you were saying, the different types of formats you may receive items in or having to go out and gather the information yourself, seeing exactly some of the problems that are happening at the knowledge base itself is really useful to get a better understanding of the situation as a whole. I do want to encourage people to send in questions. I think this is a time where we can go ahead and have questions for all of our speakers today. I think that some of the questions that we are seeing come in maybe for a particular presentation, but there are others where maybe all of our speakers can join in and we can have this be more of a open conversation rather than just a simple Q&A session. One of the things that I know that before we do get started, I do want to mention is, Maria, as you were pointing out about the different types of issues when it comes to different titles and not only the what's, you know, alternate titles or misspellings perhaps that might come to you, but including the idea of title changes that might happen, that NISO actually has a new group that was approved at the beginning of this year but is having needed some time to get itself together and has its first call coming up. It's called PIJ. It's the Presentation and Identification of E-Journals, and it's looking at a lot of those issues as well. I'm trying to figure out how does this relate to the other initiatives that are going on and how do we engage groups like Serial Solutions in on these projects so that we can have that and our libraries and other providers, of course, so we can have that definite insight in on these things. So that's something for everyone to keep an eye out as well. But in the meantime, we do have a few questions, so go ahead and get started. One is actually from Texas State for you, Maria. It's asking about affiliation of Serial Solutions and ProQuest and whether ProQuest databases are KBART compliant. I know that Serial Solution is a KBART supporter, endorser, and has been shown to have Serial Solutions data be compliant with KBART. But can you speak to how ProQuest might be a part of that? Do you know whether or not you work closely with them?
Right. Actually, I don't believe that they have applied for that recognition yet. We're going through, ProQuest is going through a transition to a new platform. And so I think that they're working through some of those issues right now. That's about as much as I know on that front at the moment. But they do support, they actually do support Onyx SOH, and they do have an Excel format that, that as I mentioned, they're working on revising that with the new platform.
There's also a question here that is about the term target source. If you can maybe explain that a little bit more for those who may not be as familiar with that terminology.
Oh, by target source, I simply mean anyone who has electronic full-text content. So, you know, for us, a target source is a ProQuest database or an EBSCO database or, you know, a Gale database. And so, mm-hmm. you know, so from a, so a referring source being a citation, and, you know, that's what the, you know, that's where the end user is starting. They simply have an abstract or a citation from a referring source. We need to help guide them to a good target for that, someone who's going to be able to fulfill that request for full text. So basically, it's a full text database.
Mm-hmm. And, Andres, I believe that in KBART, the Phase 1 report, there was actually some glossary of terms like that. Isn't that right? Where because it can be confusing coming into this arena and really understanding what comes from where and who provides what. But I do believe that the KBART recommended practice does have a glossary of some of those terms that can be helpful.
Yeah, I think so too, yeah. I think maybe we can post the link on the website after the webinar. But that's
perfect.
What I remember as well, yeah.
That's an excellent idea. I'll make certain to do that. There's also a question here going back to IOTA, asking about whether or not, and going through all of the data that you all are receiving, are you using a statistician to help to analyze this data? How is this data being analyzed?
This is Adam.
Adam can jump in. Adam, is that you who started to speak? Go ahead. I was going to give a short answer and then let you say anyway, so just go right ahead.
Okay. The short answer is no. I don't think any of us are statisticians. The longer, more interesting answer is the nature of the reference, dynamic reference linking makes it very, very difficult to, as Maria and all of us actually have mentioned, to kind of pinpoint where the problem is. So when the library world shifted in the late 90s and early 2000s from these bilateral relationships, the bilateral linking from one vendor to another, to this dynamic reference linking, which became OpenURL, the system of moving from one node in that network to another became more complex, and it became harder to kind of pinpoint where the problem is. So the emphasis in IOTA is on describing the data that's coming out as accurately as possible. So parsing the log files in itself is a task, a very important task, in normalizing the data that way. And then once we get it in a normalized form, we can get really kind of powerful results with pretty simple math, and which you can see just comparing the one vendor to the average or one vendor to another to see whether or not they have the most critical fields that, you know, Maria mentioned there. Those are the fields that we're weighting, that we'll be weighting more highly. So that's the longer answer.
It is. It does seem to be that a recurring theme through all of this is really it's that normalization of the data, of making certain that that is what happens, whether or not it's at the OpenURL level or, you know, with as Maria, you were pointing out, with, you know, people putting in proprietary formats versus, you know, KBART, that does seem to be the biggest issue. One of the – Chris brings up an interesting question where he mentions that the audience here has been polled today to figure out how big of a problem the audience thinks this is, but sort of turns that question back around on our speakers today and asks, you know, how big of a problem do you think does Serial Solutions think this is, for instance? And there's also some question whether or not some specific platforms might ever standardize, and one in particular that's mentioned is LexisNexis, for instance. But for all of our speakers, you know, we've asked our attendees what they are experiencing and what they think of the problem, but obviously you must think this is a big enough problem as well to be engaged in this. So what do you all have to say? Is this a number one issue, for instance, for your programmers? Or Maria, is this a major factor that Serial Solutions is looking at as an issue?
This is absolutely front and center in everything that we do, because what's interesting is that, you know, with the proprietary formats and what I've seen, a lot of content providers do think more about sort of what is the current title for a journal. So we typically don't receive title histories. So I guess what I'm saying is a lot of the information that we have coming to us from all of these potential full-text targets, and we need it in the knowledge base so that when, you know, when the referring source comes in, when a user says, I need this article, it needs to look at the library profile and say, well, you know, where should I potentially direct this user to get them to the full text? And mm-hmm. what's interesting is the amount of or the number of files that we receive where we don't have title histories or where we had inaccurate ISSNs or where the coverage dates are, you know, a little iffy, or where the way they represent embargoes takes a little investigation to make sure that we're doing it accurately. And that's key to being able to successfully resolve these links. So we, you know, that is our focus, is making sure this data is accurate, and then also advocating on behalf of the end users to say, you know, well, why don't you give us the title histories? And, you know, by the way, your ISSNs. So this is very important to us. And then likewise, on the side of actually taking that information and creating the syntax and creating a successful link then on to the target source for that user, we do spend a great deal of time analyzing how do target sources handle, how do these full-text databases that we're trying to send a user to, what will be most successful, because it really does vary greatly from potential database to potential database, and it changes over time. So it isn't as if we can analyze it, create the linker, and walk away. We have to monitor, well, how is that going? Is it, you know, has something changed? And as I said, it's always remarkable to me when I see a case where someone is handling a DOI well and then they stop handling that well, because to me that is, you know, that one's going to be lock solid if we can send that one along. So we spend a fair amount of time on things that relate to data quality and data handling in the various handshakes and exchanges.
I know that KBARTS has been very, it works very closely with publishers and content providers, and one of the things that has comes up in the discussions around KBARTS is often just how important this is for someone who is providing content, you know, that this making certain that these, that users can then access that content is key to their business model. So really, it does seem that this is a major issue, not only for those organizations that are making certain that they're able to access what is being paid for, or for those researchers who are wanting to make certain that they can actually get to the materials that they are finding in a database, but it does seem like that for it's really across the supply chain that this might be an issue, that this might be something where really some attention is paid.
Yeah, and I think a case can be made that it's really in their best interest to provide that accurate information, those title histories, accurate coverage dates. Because, again, that means that, you know, someone like me, I'm going to be sending someone directly to, you know, your content, because I know that you have this title from the 1980s for this citation that someone, you know, they need to text.
Absolutely.
I can only agree to what you both said. I mean, also for us, from our perspective, from the publisher's perspective, it's very important that the open URLs and the DOI links, that they're working properly. Otherwise, the users will not be able to view our content. And I mean, that's what we all want in the end, the publisher and the users, of course, that our content is used, and the users, they need our content for their research, etc. So it's really important that these links are working properly.
And it all sort of goes back to, I think, something that I think it may have been in our first presentation today, just the idea of how important electronic content is today, and what a different world we're dealing with. So having So it's clear that these initiatives are coming forward and organizations are paying attention to this simply because we're seeing that this is a key item in the process. There is another question about DOIs, and we'll have this maybe be our last question of the day. I do appreciate once again all of our attendees for dealing with us and having a late start, but I don't want to keep you all too late today. But one of our last questions today is a basic question about DOIs. What agencies create the DOIs is the question here. Is that always coming directly from the publisher or the content provider? And this can go to any one of our speakers today. Or is it always that publisher goes to Crossref to get the DOI and then it's passed along in the supply chain, or that can those things be perhaps applied later?
I mean, I'm not an expert on this topic. I can only say what we do. I mean, we have, the DOI has a certain prefix which is assigned to our company, so that's the prefix that we use for the DOI, and then we use for books or journals, we use our internal identifier as a second part of the DOI, and then we send the data to Crossref and have them registered there. So basically we define the DOI and then we register it at Crossref within a given prefix that has been assigned to us.
Well, that's very helpful. There was a second part to the question that's slightly separate, but it's asking, so how cooperative are content providers when it comes to adopting these standards, when it comes to, you know, and being engaged with KBART or IOTA or other efforts that might be out there? What are your thoughts? And this, again, I'll open to all of our speakers.
This is Adam. I'll mention. We have EBSCO, Oliver Pesch from EBSCO, and we have two great people from Thompson, Jim Wismer and Ellen Rottenberg, who are on the IOTA group. The rest of us are librarians. One of the things that we left out of the presentation that Elizabeth did was the notion that we have a focus on quarterly reports in the system, and our hope is that we will get the attention of content providers who are sending out open URLs, and they'll start looking at their reports, and as they make improvements internally, we will see those reflected in future reports. So we're only getting started, really, in terms of engaging that community, but mm-hmm. we're definitely going there.
Well, certainly I can speak from NYSO's perspective that we see a great deal of interest in the content providers in adopting these standards. That I think it goes back to what Andreas was saying, you know, and Maria as well, just that if this is in our best interests, it's good for the entire information community. And so I do see that there's a lot of growth, certainly with KBART Phase 2 and its registry and endorsement said, those are fairly new things that have been created, and we're starting to see a lot of growth in those areas. And I imagine we'll see now that there's some helpful information about how to use these recommended practices, that there'll be even greater adoption. So I think that there's a great deal of cooperation, and I think that we'll be able to see even more of that in the future. So with that positive final step, I am going to go ahead and put out our feedback survey for those attendees who have joined us at previous NYSO webinars. You are probably familiar with this. For those of you who aren't, it's just a very brief survey to get some insight onto how you think today went. It also has in here a section that has for additional questions. I do encourage you to send in any additional thoughts that you might have or questions that you might have for our speakers today. We will be posting all those questions, both from today's event as well as any others that you might come up with and add to the survey up onto our website, and make certain that there are answers there as well. We will be also, as I mentioned at the beginning, sending out archive information. You should hear back from us on that within 24 to 48 hours. But I'd like to, again, thank all of our speakers today for your excellent presentations, and I hope that all of our attendees will continue to follow on this work and do send in any kinds of feedback that you might have. And thank you all for attending today and for your patience as we dealt with some technical issues at the beginning. With that, I hope you all have a very good afternoon.